1994 at the age, at the tender age of 39. As president, a position he held until 1998, he put together a comprehensive national development strategy based on the tenets of sustainability, sound economics, investment in human development, and a strong alliance with nature. He pioneered the linkage between sustainable development and technology, work which he has continued extensively after leaving government. In the year 2000, President Figueres joined the World Economic Forum as a managing director and later became its first CEO. Since 2008, President Figueres has served as chairman of the Global Fairness Initiative, taking on the role from its founding chairman, President Bill Clinton. From 2009 until 2011, when its mandate was completed, President Figueres served on UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's advisory group on climate change and energy. He has also served as the director of the World Wildlife Fund, the World Resources Institute, and the Stockholm Environment Institute, among many, many, many other organizations. Currently, and since 2010, he's been the chairman, and soon to be the president, of the Carbon War Room, an independent not-for-profit organization focused on the global transition to a low-carbon economy. He's also the CEO of Concordia 21, dedicated to supporting organizations that promote development and democratic values around the world. President Figueres holds an engineering degree from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and a master's in public administration from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. It is a real pleasure to have you here, Jose Maria. I finish by saying that with your eloquence and vision in promoting values of sustainable human development that are very dear to us, you make us Costa Ricans proud every day. You do it effectively all over the world and at the highest level. But most importantly, you have done it with genuine commitment since well before you became a public figure, and I commend you for that. Welcome to Brookings. The floor is yours.
Sure. Buenos días, amigas y amigos. Don Kevin, muchísimas gracias. Usted siempre demasiado generoso. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. Thank you, Kathy, for your wonderful conduction of this morning's panel, and thank you to our panelists for being all here with us this morning. And thanks to Brookings and El Banco Centroamericano de Integración Económica for inviting us to this conversation on climate. Indeed, a very important and relevant one. I believe very firmly that climate change is the, on the one hand, greatest challenge, but certainly the greatest opportunity that we have faced in our humanity with respect to moving into a world where we can all live much better. And, of course, taking advantage of that opportunity requires a good amount of vision, a lot of thought leadership, of which we have heard here this morning, and work. Our colleagues on the panel have very much covered the subject from a Central American point of view. With your permission, I would like to zoom out of the region for a few minutes and then zoom back in, because I believe it's relevant to the conversation on Central America and on what we do in terms of climate change to kind of look back with a broad brush at where we're coming from in terms of understanding where the opportunities towards the future may lie. So in that order, let me start off by reminding all of us that until the year 2007, the world enjoyed over a decade of frank economic growth. Asia, of course, was in the lead, but Latin America grew. Africa grew 4 or 5% in a sustained way, and the countries that are center, the developed countries, grew as well. We brought millions of people out of poverty, and we began the creation of a new middle global class, with another 300 million in China that moved into a middle class, and another 200 million in India that did the same, which of course have also had an after effect in the patterns of consumptions of commodities and of foods and their prices around the world. If a Martian had been observing the Earth during that decade or so, he would have probably have said something like, interesting what Homo sapiens is doing down on Earth. It seems like they have finally gotten their act together. They organized one giant factory over in China and Asia with one giant store over in the U.S. and the West in which to sell all of those products. And in the middle, everybody is making money and living much better off. So then comes, of course, the crisis in 2008 and 2009, which I believe is not only an economic crisis, but also a crisis in terms of how we see ourselves vis-a-vis climate change. We resurrected Keynes. We were going to spend our way out of the crisis, which has left us with debt levels which are now in the order of 10, 11% of GDP around the world in the developed nations. When I was in government, which seems to be more than the last century ago, if you dared to come close to 3% of GDP as your deficit, you had the IMF and the World Bank and IDB and CABE and everybody all over you. And now 10, 11% is the norm, and nobody glitches. Times have changed. More worrying than that is the unemployment that has come as a unintended consequence of this crisis. And if that same Martian that had seen us during the 10 years or 12 of growth between before 2007 was looking at us during the crisis, the Martian would have probably said, interesting developments down on Earth. They seem to have overheated and gone into some problems. And now the governments that stepped in to save the markets are being shorted by the markets. Because in effect, what we have seen is governments stepping in to save the markets, and markets later on turning around and shorting currencies and doing this and doing that, and very much, in a way, not being as productive as I feel they could have been in terms of this economic recovery. So after that, we have gone through this short period of discussing what the crisis and the economic recovery would look like. And just about every economist has had his own opinion. Every engineer of us, we have our own opinions. Everybody has their own. We all like to be Monday morning quarterback. So I've heard economists say this is U-shaped, others V-shaped, then W-shaped, because we may have a double dip. And I stopped counting when I read somebody say that it was more like the sign of a square root, which then brought to mind the fact that perhaps we had run out of letters in the alphabet in terms of describing the problem and the way we were going to come out of it. My concern is that in coming out of it, we may be rearranging the chairs on the Titanic, and that we're not seizing the opportunity to move in the direction of a new low-carbon economy. I mention rearranging the chairs on the deck of the Titanic because I don't see very much thought leadership that is going into solving the crisis in a sustainable way with instruments that would not eventually get us back into the same rut in which we are. And I specifically mention that concern because I feel that we are facing, for the first time ever, with more transparency than we would have been able to do so in the past, three major and important developments. The first one, Juan Jose mentioned in his presentation, which is population growth. It took us 10,000 generations to reach the first 1 billion around 1825, then only 100 years to go to 2 billion, then 75 to go to 5 or 6. Today we're 7, going to 9. Now, those 9 billion of us that we will be in 35 years or less, or the 7 billion of us today, we all want to live much better than we do so. And we have a right to that aspiration, especially the 6 billion that are not living the types of lives that 1 billion of us already are. But then again, unless we change our way of going about development, I'm afraid that against that population growth, we're facing the limits of our planetary system. You know? 2 years ago, China became the number one market for the selling of cars. It's great for them. At that point in time, there were 140 vehicles per 1,000 Chinese versus 920 here in the U.S. per 1,000 U.S. citizens, 620 or 610 in the EU. Now, if the transportation system of the future is like the one we have in the U.S., we better find 2 more planets with the iron, oil, aluminum, and everything else that goes into the building of vehicles, because it just simply isn't enough. The second barrier we're facing up against is energy. There's been a profound transformation in the energy markets. Today, supply and demand are stabilized around 78, 79 million barrels per day. But some of the transformation is that as 20 years ago, most oil was produced in OECD nations. Today, most oil is coming from unstable regions of the world. Energy, at least in the case of this country, and I would venture many others, is much more an issue of national security. Thank you, of national security, as much an issue of national security as it is of energy, and that bodes with challenges for the future. And of course, the energy that we're using, which is mainly fossil-based, is creating a very unstable climate, as our friends on the panel have already amply demonstrated, not only with respect to Central America, but with respect to the rest of the world. So are we rearranging the chairs on the deck of the Titanic instead of taking the opportunity in coming out of a crisis to shift in the direction of a low-carbon economy, which I believe would create the jobs we need? IMF figures say we are confronted now with 400 million people out of work as a product of the financial crisis and others, but that's a responsibility we have. It would provide the jobs, the opportunities for entrepreneurship, for investment, for mobilization of capital, as we reinvent our lifestyles, the way we transport ourselves, the way we work, the way we interact in society, and we move in the direction of low carbon. So moving in the direction of low carbon requires 2 things: good, proper regulatory frameworks. That's a responsibility for governments, for international agreements. I come from a small country that understands the importance of these regulatory frameworks that has been again highlighted by some of our members on the panel. Costa Rica is a country today that has 34% of its territory in national parks, 92% of its energy is renewable based. Back in 1995, we passed a carbon tax, which allows us to purchase environmental services. And back in 1998, we exported the first 1 million tons of carbon fixed as a commodity into the international markets. That is a consequence of regulatory frameworks. But there's not a lot of appetite in the politics of today around the world to move in that direction. Somehow, we are again caught up in doing the urgent without paying importance to the important issues that we should be looking at. And coming out of the economic crisis has become our focus, while we should be looking at what direction we're coming out of it in terms of not repeating some of the mistakes of the past. Moving to a low-carbon economy is on the one side, then, regulatory frameworks. On the other side, a lot of investment and mobilization of capital. And this is where a tremendous opportunity for the private sector lies in terms of moving into these areas, as major leading global corporations are already doing. You have global corporations in the U.S. like General Electric and so many others that are doing that. You have companies in other parts of the world such as Siemens that already have 24% of their sales coming from their activities and their products, and they're going into the market in this new migrating to low carbon economy. Let me give you some relevant examples of what can be done, because again, here, as we all know, I think it is opportune to remind ourselves that 50% of carbon emissions today can be solved through good business viable propositions without any need for further regulation or legislation. So until the governments and the international agreements get their act together, which may take a long time, let's move on the 50% that we can already reduce by making it a good viable business, an opportunity for investment, for job creation, for entrepreneurship, for new technology applications, and at the same time, let's move ahead with adaptation, which is another very important component of this equation, precisely because of the amount of carbon we already have in the atmosphere. Examples. Kevin was kind enough to mention my responsibilities with the Carbon War Room. We identify sectors of the global economy where, by reinventing the business model, filling an information gap, or looking at things in a different way, we can unlock the barriers to deploying capital that will reduce carbon emissions. Shipping industry. 100,000 ships out there are sailing our oceans. 65,000-70,000 of them are overfishing, what little is left of our fisheries, thanks to bad policies like subsidies, for example, which are the most pervasive thing that one can think of. But that's a different day for a different story on fishing. The remaining 30,000 ships are doing the world's commerce. You take these ships today, you put them on a dry dock, which are usually in depressed areas. You create jobs when you put them up on a dry dock. You deploy on these ships you put on them off-the-shelf technologies we already have today. You invest about $3 or $4 million per ship, roll it down off the dry dock 6 to 8 weeks later, and that ship is going to consume 20 to 30% less energy. Just painting the ship's hull with the new paints that are available today, given the technological advancements we have, reduces the coefficient of drag between 5 and 8%. That investment in painting pays for itself in less than 12 months. The total energy conversion pays for itself in less than 36 months. And those 30,000 ships emit carbon today equivalent of the sixth national emitter. So they would be between Germany and Japan if all of those 30,000 ships were a country. Classical example where we can deploy capital, create jobs, opportunities for investment, give a lot of oomph to technologies that are already there, and reduce carbon at the same time. Zooming back in to the region, there are enormous opportunities to undergo the same types of transformation in Central America, and as a matter of fact, in the rest of Latin America as well, not to mention, of course, the opportunities that lie here in the United States, which are bountiful and enormous. But in the context of Central America, some of my colleagues on the panel, again, have already discussed these. but opportunities with respect to demand-side management. With 50% of the world's population living in cities and a lot of migration in Central America going towards our cities, buildings construction has become a major emitter of carbon. Today, you can go into these buildings, you can look at their energy use, you can look at the way you put them together, how we are going to make them more workable, but how we are going to decrease the cost of maintenance over time in a sustainable way. And building retrofits, not only in Central America, but here in the U.S. and in Europe, is a tremendous enhancer of job opportunities very rapidly, very quickly, and the payback is less than 48 months. What's required there are the financial mechanisms and instruments to be able to put this together, which here in the States they have already begun to solve with PACE, for example, even in spite of its challenges, and other mechanisms that are already there, but that they can be transformed and brought to other parts of the world. A second low-hanging fruit in the case of Central America is renewable energies. There is absolutely no reason why Central America cannot move with an aggressive plan to be 90, 80, 100% based on renewable energies over the next 20 years. It would create a tremendous amount of opportunity in investment, in job creations, in the infrastructure that we need in the region, instead of continuing to rely on fossil fuels, which are only going to get more expensive as we continue to move forward, and which already have a tremendous impact on the balance of payments of Central America and other countries like ours in the region. A third possibility is to advance together with renewable energies in the confirmation of smart grids. There's a lot of Central America that is still off the grid. So why not apply the same logic here of the transformation and revolution we saw with respect to cell phones? Countries used to bury copper in the ground to get fixed lines to every point. Cells come along, and all of a sudden we have an explosion of cells precisely and mainly in those countries that did not bury copper that could migrate and leap forward fast into cellular telephony. There's an opportunity for Central America to build out the grid where it doesn't have it as a smart grid and allow off-grid generation and advance towards a new composition of its energy sector that, again, is a tremendous job creator and enhancer of investment and opportunities. Water has been addressed here, and I would also single out transportation as a tremendous regional opportunity that would link our countries in a much better way than we have today. So in that respect, I think that there are two additional dimensions that we have to think of, or three. One dimension is that Central America has to look at itself as Central America. We in Costa Rica are not very good Central Americans. We in Costa Rica are not very good Central Americans because we have no army, they have an army, we've had democracy longer than they have had democracy, we have reached another level of well-being than the rest of our Central American brothers. No somos muy buenos centroamericanos. And that is a false point of departure in terms of being able to capture the opportunities that we could capture as a region. I was very much a Central American integration person when I was in government, and that is the line forward. But many of these challenges become all of a sudden much more attractive to foreign investment from a scale dimension and become much more economic for our countries if we look at our countries as an integrated proposition. Hard, difficult, whatever, but these are challenging times. We should step up to the plate, change our attitudes, and move in that direction. In that same dimension, the bilateral organizations or bilateral agreements should be much more what comes into vogue when we're discussing issues such as climate change. And at the multilateral level, the region could certainly benefit from a tremendous amount of cohesion or coordination between the multilateral bodies. The World Bank, IDB, Banco Centroamericano de Integración Económica, Corporación Andina de Fomento, they all have their plan with respect to Central America. And now you have ministries in Central America that can hardly deal with one institution, having to deal with four of them that have their different agendas. I mean, I don't know what the distance is between the head of the World Bank and the head of IDB here in Washington. It's not monumental. But 2 days of sitting together to coordinate policies with respect to the region, I think would go a long way in terms of being serious about what we want to do in Central America. At the end of the day, this, queridas amigos y amigos, and with this I finish, will require at least two things. One is values. We need to review our values. I heard Tom Friedman the other night say that what democracy meant as a value to our forefathers, sustainability must mean to us in our generation. And I think that's a beautiful way of capturing the moment in which we are and in the direction in which we need to move. Unless we become absolutely serious with respect to these issues of sustainability, we're going to have a very unhappy and very unfriendly planet. And the other issue required here is leadership. Because we need to move on these issues with a medium and long-term vision that transcends short-term governments, and that looks at the world that we can build with what we already have as we continue to find the missing pieces we don't have today to complete the equation in terms of where we want to go to. Muchísimas gracias, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, Jose Maria, for a very lucid and eloquent as ever presentation. I guess I have two reactions. One is about an issue that you touched upon at the end, which is the politics of all this. In your case, you happen to understand the issues at stake extremely well. I'm sorry to say that that's not the case of most of the members of our political elites, certainly in Central America. So when you take a glance at the kind of political debate that we have in our countries, I mean, it's a debate that is rife with ignorance on the one hand, and with short-termism on the other. And mind you, some of the ignorance leads to things that are reasonably well-intentioned but can have perverse effects. I was, Pascal mentioned something that really, stayed in my head, which is the issue of tourism. You know, the tourism industry. You know, it's an industry that, in the case of Costa Rica, is promoted, and rightly so, as a low emissions kind of sector, but that in the case of coastal areas holds very serious problems of sustainability. And I guess the same applies to things like generation from hydropower. You know, things that are promoted with very good intention but can have very perverse effects in some cases. And that's, to some extent, the result of ignorance. So my first question would be, how do you see the politics of this evolving in Central America? I mean, is it a matter of a generational change? Is it a matter of preaching ceaselessly the kind of things that you told us about until you drill this kind of thing in the heads of politicians? How do we make this happen? That's number one. And number two, and again, specifically in the case of Central America, we have, you sort of alluded to this in an oblique way. In the case of Central America, we have a problem that we have to deal with in myriad ways in virtually every issue in the region, which is the issue of coordination between governments. It's a tall order in Central America, and you know, climate change is not my specialty, but I know this very well in the case of public security and the strategy against drug trafficking. I mean, coordination has become a huge stumbling block. So how do we go about this? How do we enhance the level of coordination that we see in the region regarding a vital life or death, literally, challenge such as climate challenge, such as climate change, and the adaptation to it?
So on the first one, Kevin, on the issue of political gridlock and short-termism, you will be pleased to realize, again, as you well know, that Central America does not have a monopoly. You know, I've been living in Europe for the last 11 years. I haven't found a single European leader that has a clear vision with respect to what the European Union should look like. There is no European vision that would guide that bloc, and I certainly believe that the world is a better place with the European Union. I would want to live in a world where human rights, democracy were upheld by the European Union instead of being upheld by some other geographies out there. And when you come to speak about political gridlock and not moving on this agenda, the U.S. takes the cake. So we don't have the monopoly on this. But I have to say that there is a lot to be done today by looking at things through the prism of how do we put together national development strategies, proyectos país, that transcend short-term, four-year governments. And that is a call for the private sector and for civil society to engage. I haven't seen one single successful country, Singapore, Ireland, Israel, some others out there, that has achieved its success based only on good governments. What I have seen is public-private partnerships where there is a cohesion with respect to a vision of how to position the country, and all sectors cooperate and keep checks and balances and controls on each other for the movement to go generally in that direction. Governments can then come in and change this or that on the frill, as governments should do, depending on what they have been elected to do. But in Latin America, and especially in Central America, we need to make the distinction between política de Estado y política de gobierno. Política de Estado that transcend the short-termism and move forward. Política de gobierno, those changes that every government can make. So a lot of that thinking is necessary. And, as a complement to it, It is much easier to align our thoughts and actions when we're thinking about something out there 10 or 15 years than when we're thinking about aligning our actions with respect to something we want to accomplish tomorrow. And there's a lot to be done by every sector in Central America. Your second question,
coordination between governments in Central America,
was with respect to coordination. Bueno, Don Luis mentioned several times in his presentation the Central American institutionality, la CCAD y el sistema del SICA. I believe a lot in those organizations. I wish they were much stronger than they are, but they're very weak. Push comes to shove, they're very weak. They're not a mechanism for coordination in the region. I think that is a responsibility of our top leaders in the region. I think that is a responsibility of our top leaders. That's a presidential issue. And on that, we cannot point to any one country in particular because we all have pretty bad records in terms of achieving that coordination. But I do have to say here again that in achieving that coordination, it would also be very helpful to have a cohesive point of view, one point of view, from the multilateral world. And when you don't have that, it just mixes things up in such more of a complicated way. Just because you touched it on in 30 seconds, but one of my main concerns, again raised by the panel today, is the situation of security, personal safety, and drug cartels in Central America. I mean, we're caught in the middle of a giant clam. On the south, you have the U.S. and Colombia that have been relatively successful because, irrespective of what we want to think about Plan Colombia, has been successful. I think they have carried the day. Okay. And on the north, coming down, you have the U.S. and Mexico. In the middle, you have Central America, thousands of kilometers of coastlines, thousands of square kilometers of jungles, with no infrastructure through which to combat drugs, cartels, and all that brings with it. No infrastructure, no intelligence, no security, no institutionality. You mentioned no coordination, nothing. My personal point of view, it may not be very popular back home, but I think we should just outsource that to the U.S. Outsource it. U.S. Coast Guard, U.S. Navy, come down both coasts. Install your radars where you want to install them. Have your flying planes where you want to have them flying. Help us on all of this. I mean, that's a practical point of view. First of all, we have more intelligent things to use our resources for. We still have development challenges. So if the U.S. is willing to pick up the tab on that, and I think they would be willing to pick up the tab, I would outsource it to the U.S. We're never going to do a better job. They may not do a very good one, but we're never going to do a better one.
Thank you, Jose Maria. Well, the floor is open to questions from the audience. I'm sure there are quite a few.
Thank you. Lisa Friedman again from ClimateWire. This has been a real honor. Thank you for speaking to us.
Thank you.
I was hoping to get your thoughts on how the UN climate process, I mean, where that stands right now. It seems that despite all of the very hard work by your sister and others, a lot of the agreements over the past couple years have been more aimed at saving the process than saving the planet. And I'm wondering with the very on-the-ground work that you're talking about that needs to be done now and in the next few years, and an international agreement not on the horizon this decade, what is the role and what is the what's the word I'm looking for? But how can the UNFCCC work with the private sector and others that are doing the work on the ground that you're talking about now?
So can we take two or three, perhaps?
Yeah.
Of course.
Yes.
Christine Pensage from USAID again. I'd like to ask a follow-up question regarding the green jobs that you referred to. Mm-hmm. There's been a very great deal written about the importance of that to the transition out of the global depression. Certainly, it's an absolutely critical focus of the IMF and World Bank now, interestingly. And of politics in many countries. However, it seems as though there was also a very great deal written about the promise of green jobs over time, but it hasn't been prominent recently. Why is this not panning out? It would seem, you know, sort of just from energy efficiency savings, from retrofitting of buildings, all the things you mentioned, that there are many opportunities, but there are perhaps some small investments need to be made, but there have also been analyses saying that that is overstated, an overstated promise. Where is the real sort of vein of gold to be mined here?
Mm-hmm. Good question. Thank you.
Alec Watson from Hills & Company. Mr. President, I'd love to have your views on the Rio Plus 20 meeting that's coming up in 2 or 3 months.
So, Maria?
Thank you. So, on your first question with respect to the intergovernmental process, I have to say that I have been very fortunate in life because I have been upgraded from being the president of Costa Rica to now becoming the brother of Karin Krisztián Figueres. And I feel very well and very tranquil about that. And the last time I spoke to Christian, I said to her, you know, I'm going to make some cards that say, José María Figueres, brother of Karin Krisztián. And just hand them out instead of my regular cards. I will be in Juan Jose's camp there. I think we have to wish them the best, move forward as fast as you can. Hopefully you will reach an agreement. Let's be cooperative and serious about that process. And in the meantime, adiós rogando y con el mazo dando. Let's do everything else we have to do because this is time for 1,000 flowers to bloom. The challenge and the opportunity are too big, as Doña Kathy well knows from her years of working in this, for us not to take advantage of everything going forward. With respect to your question on green jobs and why aren't we more onto that, very relevant question. Perhaps 2008 and 2009 reflected not only the financial crisis, but also the environmental crisis. We have underpriced risk. With respect to the financial world, by relying on a series of financial instruments that we made up, the financial instrument economy is 10 times the real GDP economy of the world. And with respect to the environment, we have underpriced energy for decades. If energy reflected its true cost, it would be a much more efficient world. And jobs moving into the green economy and the transition to low carbon would have taken place decades ago. Pero nunca es tarde cuando la dicha es buena. And let's take advantage of the situation we have today and make a lot more of this viable. So let me give you an example of one consortium, because this is reinventing the wheel in that respect, that we've put together at the Carbon War Room. We brought in an engineering company that goes in and does the assessments into buildings on how much energy can be shared. Reduced.
Saved.
Thank you. Not shared. Saved. Thank you. Muchas gracias. Saved. That's Lockheed Martin. We brought in an insurance company that goes in after the engineering company and says, effectively, yes, Brookings could reduce 20% of its energy if somebody went and did everything that the engineering company said. The insurance company is Hannover Re. Then we found a bank and asked the bank, would you be willing to finance the conversion? Because now you have an engineering company that says it can be done, and you have a company that's willing to write an insurance policy that says there's a 20% reduction which provides a cash flow to pay back the bank. That's Barclays Bank. And then the companies that come in with the white vans that roll up here in the front, take out their ladders, get into Kevin's office and everybody else's office, and redo this building. Okay, that first consortium has now been funded to the tune of $650 million by Barclays to begin doing retrofits in this country. That is a type of movement forward that we need that will create these green jobs. But it's rethinking also how we do these things. It's reinventing the business models. And we need to look at these things with a clean perspective, because we're used to looking at them in a very different way. La tercera pregunta de nuestro querido embajador. Rio Plus 20. When is that going to take place?
June.
June. This year. Rio Plus 20. What's the agenda? What are the issues we're all going to go down to Rio to solve? What's the discussion? What's the agenda? What's the outcome? I'm not so convinced about that. Con todo respeto. And I don't think that the solution to the environmental challenge we have in front of us is creating a brand new environmental organization, the mother of all environmental organizations, as some are proposing. I don't think that's the way forward. Pero I've been wrong many times.
Can take a couple more questions, and then we have to wrap up.
One thing Brookings could do to save energy is tone down the air conditioning in the I'm freezing. Huh? I bet you this isn't.
You're not alone in that one.
I bet you this isn't 23 or 24 degrees.
That's an excellent point. Thank you, President Figueres. I'm with the U.S. mission to the Organization of American States, and we're anxiously looking forward to Kevin's arrival next week. I wanted to ask you a question about the Central American experience with electrical interconnection, CIEPAC.
Yep.
It's been proposed now for the region as a new initiative, and I'm wondering if you see benefits from the mitigation side of interconnection and what some of the challenges are in that process.
Thank so a short story about that, if I may, because everything in life has a story. I get elected in 1994. I go to La Primera Cumbre Iberoamericana, Cartagena de Indias, November of 94, and in my briefing papers, I get briefed in all of these papers about CIEPAC. The Central American presidents were going to have a conversation at that time with Felipe González because Spain was paying for a lot of CIEPAC. Da-da-da-da-da, great thing, da-da-da-da-da. So I start to look into the papers and find out about this, and I can't recall now how many years, but this CIEPAC conversation had been a conversation that had already been ongoing by 1994 for, I think, at least 5 years. At least 5 years. Now I understand we're in 2012. No, I don't understand that. I know that. But I understand that we have just arrived at the culminating moment of CIEPAC. Pero nos ha llevado 20 años. O sea, de verdad, we have to be a lot more serious in the region when it comes to solving our problems. And these are not issues that anybody has a responsibility to solve for us. It's we Central Americans that need to solve this. We can't go on and be serious if it takes us 20 years to get CIEPAC in place. No se vale. No se vale. So now that we have it, let's make the most out of it. I do believe it's a great instrument of integration. I think it gives us a possibility to rethink our energy across the region, to see how we're going to balance the loads, to have a forward-looking vision of what we want to do. What happens if oil goes to 140? What happens if something happens in the Strait of Hormuz and oil goes to 200? You know, where does the Central American economies lie, and how do we get out of that position and that reliance on carbon fuels in the next 10 years? And we use CIEPAC as an instrument of integration. We hold hands, todos los centroamericanos. We come to the World Bank and to the IDB and to the others and say, this is what we want to do. Or we go to China and we say, turnkey job. But come do this. Because perhaps we can't agree on it. Turnkey job, come do it. Bring your Chinese workers, set up the camps, bring in the food, you know, the way you built the stadium in Costa Rica, the way you do things in other places in the world, whatever way. But if we can't get our act together to do it, let's find some way to do it. Es que no hay tiempo para desperdiciar. Y a mí me da mucho coraje que pasemos en cosas tontas peleándonos entre nosotros en Centroamérica instead of being doing the things that are important and that are urgent. So looking at our energy matrix is a very important thing to do. I'm sorry, I kind of get passionate about these things. Bueno, let's go to work.
Thanks so very much. This has been a fascinating session or couple of sessions. It's been a real honor to have you here, Jose Maria, and a real joy. It's been a real joy to have you, the panelists on the first panel, here as well. And I certainly hope, as a Central American, that that we do more of this, particularly here in Washington. I tried to do a little bit of that over the past year, but clearly there's much more to be done. And the issues in Central America are not going away. Particularly this issue is not going away anytime soon. So I want to thank you all for being here, and I want to thank you for your support for the Latin American Initiative. And I want to thank CABE for the support of what we're doing here. And as I said, you know, as I said before, I'll miss you and I'll see you around. Thank you so
Kevin,
much.
Kevin, one note.
And
one
a round of applause.
One note, just on what you said, doing this in Washington. So here in Washington, we have the White House and the Hill taken by the IDB on one side, La OEA on the other side, and PAHO on the other side. That's a great positioning. Can you imagine if Asia had that? What's wrong with us?
Plenty. Plenty. Don't get me started on that. So a round of applause for our speakers. Thanks so much.